Welcome to Ever Beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Good evening. It's the 16th of July, just about here in the UK, around about midnight over here. And good afternoon and good evening to those in the States and around the world. Tonight is a return of one of my favorite guests. We also have him on the station occasionally as a play as stuff. Always spontaneous, always interesting, always controversial, always very sharp-minded. A Renaissance man of our times. Now, I'm not crawling up, so just stay chill. But a Renaissance man of our times. He's an artist, he's a musician, a writer, a performer, a speaker, TV show host now, radio show. He does all of it, everything himself. I don't know where you have the time. You must have about five or six clones. Good evening, Thomas Sheridan. How are you?
Great to be back, JP, and thanks for that very flattering introduction. No, I'm a workaholic and I'm also an insomniac, and that kind of helps when you're both.
That's where you find the time for it. You make more time. So where we were starting is, just on the pre-call here, you mentioned the piece, the stone that I sent you. Now, our audience is familiar with the stone called shungite. Which is a black rock, which is available from one place only on this planet, which is a place called Karelia, near Russia. And so we were just discussing I sent some pieces over to Ireland to Thomas, and he told me a small story. So do you want to start with that, Thomas? The shungite story.
Yeah, I never heard of shungite until you recommend. Actually, I'm not a rock or a crystal guy. I have white quartz and I'm kind of devoted to that. I have a phenomenal experience with white quartz, both from visiting megaliths and also the mountains around here. It literally falls out on top of your head in big chunks. And it is a remarkable, you know, stone, crystal, whatever. So I don't know. I never really went into looking at anything else. I was like a quartz man and that was the end of it. And you gave me the shungite, in a little package. It was about like, you gave me about 10 rocks. The biggest one was about a centimeter across and then it went down to smaller ones. And, I thought it was very pretty. It looked like coal when you first gave it to me. And even it makes it dust like coal, but it doesn't feel like coal. It's much more robust. And so what I did was, thinking I was really clever and hot shit, I got the biggest piece on it, and I got some silver wire. I make jewelry as well. That's one of my jobs also.
Yeah, and, sorry, I forgot.
I mounted the stone in the middle of a circle that someone that had a long time. It was silver plate and zinc. Like, and I knocked the center part out. It was like, there was like a kind of a Celtic design in the center. It fit perfectly in the middle. So it was like, the planet Saturn. Imagine that, right? And it was bound to the thing through this lovely silver wire, proper expensive silver wire that a friend of mine who's a real jeweler gave to me. It looked beautiful. It looked like the planet Saturn, you know, with a black thing in the middle. And I was all pleased with myself. I put it on a pendant. Threw it around my neck, and I went to bed that night, woke up the next morning, and the shine had gone completely off the silver plating. And by the end of that next day, it was stripped down to the zinc of the medallion part, and the silver wire was starting to deteriorate. It was starting to snap like electronic solder. So it was like literally sucking the silver, you know, or dissipating it or something. But it was amazing. But also another thing I noticed, I kept on wearing it. Cause I wasn't that bothered by that. But I was wearing it on top of my heart. The pendant was not deliberately, just that to where it hung on the cord. And I cannot describe the experience that it gave me. It wasn't like it could be mistaken for palpitations if you didn't really know a lot about palpitations. It felt like that, incredibly, incredibly strong. I eventually took it off because to be honest with you, it was probably not a good idea having it there. I don't have a pacemaker or anything like that, but it felt too strong. You know what I mean? Too strong. So, I put it on, I have a wand, and I have a hazel wand that I've had for years, and it's now tied around the top of that to give it a kind of aesthetic as more as anything else. And I sleep next to my bed, and the zinc thing now is, it looks like a copper pipe. There isn't a trace of silver left on any of it.
Oh, it's shungite like silver. That is amazing. So, you know, this is something we've been talking about, because people say, you know, what happened? So it was years ago, actually. Somebody said, what happens if you put shungite in colloidal silver? You know what colloidal silver is? It's like fine, tiny molecular. And it's basically molecular silver floating. Basically it sucks the silver right out. It has a tendency to, it's used in Russia to cleanse water anyway. They instead of activated carbon like we use here, they use shungite. And it's very efficient, and it doesn't need recharging like carbon and all sorts of stuff. Because it's got, basically, as I said, it's got these little black holes in it, and it takes away all the impurities.
So does the silver molecules actually go and embed themselves inside it?
Yeah. Do you know what a buckyball is? Have you heard of a buckyball?
No.
Do you know what a geodesic dome looks like?
Like the Buckminster
Exactly. That is what the molecule looks like. It looks like one of those domes. It's a spherical molecule of carbon atoms that it's like a Dyson sphere. You can surround stuff with it. And, scientists have experimented by popping molecules inside this molecule and using it as a delivery system. So you can put all sorts of stuff in. But generally, there's a kind of draft, a vacuum in the middle of the thing, and it draws impurities to it. And it really likes silver, you know, and that's quite an amazing story. It does things like that. It really does.
That's fascinating. Yeah. And I looked on Wikipedia. And it said that, and you told me this as well, it only exists in the Karelian Peninsula in Russia and Finland.
Which is
a weird part of, an interesting part of the world. That area is, like, a friend of mine, Jack Roberts, he's an English guy, he's been here for like 40 years, and he's devoted his life to rock art. And he lived up that way for a while, and he gave me a book on that area, and the rock art up there is truly bizarre. Probably the earliest representations of demons are carved into their rock art. And they're actually referred to in the local folklore as demons. But also the rock art is so common that it's literally, the examples are phenomenal in terms of its complexity. And they don't know the age of it either. They're just assuming it's either Bronze Age or Iron Age. But there is, there's a tremendous regional and local connection to the rock art that goes back through the kind of folklore tradition that's been lost everywhere else. It hasn't been applied to it. And it actually answered a huge question for me, in the Karelian culture in relation to it. All over Europe, there's things called scoop marks in a lot of Neolithic and Bronze Age rock art. They're like literally like someone put a little scoop in and scooped the piece of the rock out. And they're often have concentric circles around them, but a little scoop, right? The Karelian folklore believes that they're, now this is interesting, this comes back to the Shugite again, believes that those holes are portals to other dimensions. And what they do is they put seeds in them, and the seeds are gifts to the fairy world. And the next morning when they come up, those seeds are gone. Now, that's very similar to what you were saying about how the Shugite molecule becomes a kind of a transportation thing, and it removes, you know, it fills itself in the middle and removes something on. I'm wondering if that molecule on some kind of collective unconscious level has impinged itself in the local kind of folklore and they, you know, giving them a sort of a sense that rock is a portal or another dimension to another, a gateway to other dimensions.
I'm sure that the people who live around there, apparently these, you know, you hear about these people who live a long life because of the minerals in the water. The people who live in by the river Shunga, are obviously incredibly healthy and live a long time and all that stuff. So there's that to it. The dimensional portal. Do you know the first time I saw this material? You know, I had a girlfriend and she had a piece and we were talking about it on the station and she said, "Oh, I've got some." So I picked it up and the first thing I thought was, wow. I heard it, the theme from 2001, Thus Spake Zarathustra, in my head. This is the material that black stone in Arthur C. Clarke's novel was made from, I'm sure, because has that quality.
Absolutely. I have the bag right in front of me now and I just took out the second largest one. And what you say about its absorption qualities, it's so black, it's actually absorbing light. You know, like photons don't even exist on
absorbing
the surface.
Absorbing photons, yeah.
And they don't even exist on the surface. So it's absolutely, a terminator between this reality and the next.
So, between this reality and the next, you've been exploring those worlds in the megalith that you've been going down tunnels. You've been climbing rocks and clambering all over things in front of TV cameras. Are they kind of, like, what do you call it? Is it RT that you have in Ireland? Are they like mainstream TV shows or like independent broadcast, companies or Netflix or something like that?
No, RT are the BBC of Ireland. They're a huge public broadcaster. So they're the BBC of Ireland, but that's not who I was working for. I've been just doing it for independent production companies and also doing my own stuff now. I now have my own sort of like a company doing this. So that's, well, I've been doing this for years as a hobby. Just, you know, I've been like, you know, I've been obsessed with megaliths since I was about 8. And they took us on a school trip to Newgrange. And so it's just like always been there. You know, since I kind of got known for my books on psychopaths and mind control and social engineering, I just mentioned to people I'm mad for megaliths and stuff like that. And so I've been kind of pulled into that world, which I'm kind of glad about because I'm actually very happy there in that thing because something I was doing for a hobby, has actually become a second career for me. And that's how the book, The Druid Code, came out. And I'm also very interested in the occult, as you know, and magic and things like that. And so no one had ever applied the idea of magic and the occult in a sociological sense to these sites. And I know an awful lot about mythology, a huge amount actually. And so it opened up a second world for me, which I'm very happy and very comfortable in. And if I was to only do that for the rest of my life, I'd be delighted because it ties in everything. My art, my love of the countryside, my love of history, my fascination with things like magic and the occult and stuff like that. So yeah, that's what was happening there. All kinds of things like that. And so it's been very interesting the last couple of years that way. And I do, you know, I have been approached by RT in Ireland to do a couple of shows, or programs, but I won't touch them because they're like the BBC. I don't want that money. I don't want that world. I don't want it going near me.
Do you know, in the TV, there's a, on Scott, I think it's, I don't know if it's, it happens elsewhere, but there's a TV show that when they play really late at night called Weir's Way. Did you ever see that? Have you ever seen that thing?
No, what's no. that? Sounds good.
Well, basically it's that they were filmed in the 70s, of this guy, and he basically walks around Scotland talking about all the different ancient sites, and, you know, not so ancient sites and the history of the place. And it's called Weir's Way. And he just, it's just film of him walking and talking and doing his thing. Just going around all the different sites and,
That sounds fantastic. How do you spell his first name? How do you spell his name?
The show is called Weir's Way. W-E, no, I think I before E. W-E-I-R, apostrophe. I'm sure it's on YouTube.
Yeah, I definitely want to see that. That's right up my street.
Yeah, and you know, it's that lovely sort of 70s grainy film that they had. I think it must have been 16 mil. And then you know, he's just telling the stories, the local stories, and he goes to the pubs and they have the sessions, you know, and you know, that sounds like, you know, you could do a deeper, broader kind of version of that, and you maybe didn't, you know, you don't probably have to do all the walking, you know. Maybe they could drive you there on a Land Rover or something. But I often imagine that's the sort of format that would be ideal for you. Just film people, you know, people just need to film you, Thomas, and it's all there.
Thanks very much. And that would be a dream come true for me. That would be, if anyone out there has money, here I am. But yeah, that would be, you know, like anything else that there's production costs. I would love to do something like that. That would like, just like, that would be the career, the ultimate career epoch for me to actually do something like that. It's because I love talking to people. I love, I'm probably too honest in some ways because I'm not the best person in the world for diplomacy. If I have a feeling about something, I don't hold it back. And it's probably has caused me problems, but at the same time too, I can't be a phony. So, I mean, that's why I probably will never have a career in the mainstream, because I could never, you know, suck up to the people who protected the likes of Jimmy Savile and so on, and that kind of world. But yeah, I mean, I would love something like that, and they could edit it any way they wanted. But, you know, but yeah, that to me would be an absolute dream. I would love to do that. Not for any kind of ego thing or anything. I would just be very happy among those locations, and I'd just be very happy sharing my, God, you know, obsession with reading and history and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, just you being you. I've just posted a sample episode in there for you from YouTube, and you can see the kind of thing.
Oh, good man, thank you.
So Sheridan's Way, so where have you covered so far in the shows that you've done already on the in this format?
I have been to Malta, Sardinia, and Germany, Holland, England, Scotland, all over Ireland. Did I say Malta? Malta, and France. And that hasn't even scratched the surface. I spent a couple of days in the Odenwald in Germany, because I wanted to look at stones that, and there's actually on my occult, open source occult TV, there's a thing called the Occult Odenwald, Odenwald. And it's the last natural forest in Central Europe. And I wanted to go and visit stones that were not necessarily megaliths. Now, yes, there are sacred stones that people have collected and brought to certain sites. Absolutely. But at the same time too, there are what they call glacial erratics, or stones that have naturally landed up in certain places. That's, even though they were not put there, for whatever reason, have these remarkable qualities that attract human consciousness, that interact with the human consciousness. Now, there's a very famous one in Ireland, if you live in Ireland, at a place called the Hill of Uisnech, which is actually almost the geographic center of Ireland. And it's actually the spot, there's a stone there called the Stone of Te Cats. It's a naturally forming stone, but it's actually probably more important than all the placed megaliths. And it's also the site where Geoffrey of Monmouth said that Merlin, the magician, had taken the stones of Stonehenge and used the magical signs of the Druids to transport them to southern England. That really is code for, magical practice, secrets and that, the cult and the true meaning of the word, more so than actually floating the stones over, but the means to do it. Now, in the Odenwald, I've been wanting to go there for years, and, I had the chance to come along. I got a cheap Ryanair flight. I have a good camera equipment, the sound equipment. Took it out there, and I found the stones. And I have to say, JP, even though these were natural stones, the charge off them was absolutely ferocious. Like, for instance, I was putting compasses on them, and the things were going bonkers. GPS didn't work. Now, I did something kind of stupid as well. I decided I was going to camp in the forest overnight for two nights and wander through it. Excuse me. So when I arrived in Frankfurt, I went to a camping shop and I bought some basic camping gear. I bought a knife and stuff like that. And I went to the shops nearest to the forest in a village called Mumtal, and I bought like loads of sandwiches and stuff like that to take me over on the 2-day hike through these mountains. Now, these mountains are saturated with occult and witchcraft and paranormal and everything, right? But what I didn't know at the time was that they're full of wolves. Now, because I thought wolves were extinct in that part of Germany, which they were, but apparently wolves have been streaming into Germany since the Iron Curtain was removed from Poland. But I didn't know they were there. And something was, and on the first night through the forest, something was following me, behind me. It might have been a wild boar, probably was, because they're very nosy of humans anyway. But it was okay in the end, nothing happened. I got lost in the forest and the GPS didn't work or anything. What should have been a terrifying experience was actually a kind of a shamanic journey of sorts. I was charged and loved every second of it. Now, these forests are filled with folklore. They're filled with stories of an entity called the Wildenbicken, which is she's a wild woman, and she's like the kind of the female spirit of the forest. I could feel her everywhere. I could feel there was a giant worm called the Lind. I could feel like this kind of like Lovecraftian creature that lives in the forest. I could feel these archetypal energies everywhere, coupled with the whole thing of the stones and everything that I found. I ended up at the end of the hike in the real Frankenstein's castle on top of the mountain. And, he was a famous alchemist called Dipple, but it's actually called Frankenstein's Castle, Dipple, and it was an incredible experience. People talk about taking ayahuasca and DMT and entogens, and I mean, I've tried those things myself as well, but nothing will compare in lifetime experience to being lost for 2 days in a wild German forest that is still in 2017 saturated with ancient archetypes, folklore and spirits. And it was an incredible experience. So much so that I've actually, and this is weird. I know this is weird. I keep wanting to go back. It had that effect on me. It's almost like, the landscape, it captured me and captivated me in some sense. And I just went there out of interest because I'd read about the place. I didn't have a great sort of longing to go there. I just wanted to see this place. And it was, you know, when people talk about like, you know, people in Europe have to go to the Peruvian or the Amazon or something like that, or somewhere like really exotic to find these kind of great deep spiritual archetypes. Europe is, in certain pockets, has that in spades and more. And I've really discovered that in recent times.
That's a fascinating story, particularly, what you're saying that it has that addictive quality. The word that came to mind while you're saying that is presence. You had to be 115% present in that place on all levels, on the psychic level, on the physical level, on your listening. You know, there's apparent danger all around, and yet there you were present in the moment and safe as houses.
Yeah.
And that's
the
trick, isn't it?
I didn't feel in danger at any moment. Now, I bought this huge knife just in case in the camping shop. And when I got back to the village, Muntal, I gave it to I was staying in a B&B and I gave the knife to the kid who, the son of the owner, because I couldn't take, you can't take it back on the plane. And, I mean, not a day goes by that I want to go back. Isn't that weird? And I have no connection to this place. Now, it's called the Odenwald because it's Odin's wood. You know, it's like you're talking about the heartland of Germania, where, you know, the Romans, you know, went in and fought the Germanic tribes. But it also has, and this could be quite interesting, JP, I found out, an actual Irish connection, because there was Irish monks used to go there to Christianize the locals. You're talking about like the 6th century, who were pagans at the time. But it's almost like I was going back and feeling like my presence was apologizing for taking their native faith and their indigenous spirituality away from them. That's how I felt. I felt welcomed by the place. You know, I can't explain it. But, there was one point there where the forest was so, at night was so black. Now, it wasn't that cold. It wasn't too cold. But it was so black that my perception and vision changed, where the gaps between the trees was how I was navigating. You know, I didn't even need a flashlight. I developed this kind of natural animalistic, you know, maybe it was shamanic. Maybe I did take on the form of the wolf or something, you know. And it was just mind blowing. It was just beautiful. It just reaffirmed my paganism and my, you know, my belief that, like, you know, I know what I am. I know what my spiritual ancestry is. I know what's in my DNA. It just totally affirmed that. And I understand now why, you know, like the so-called, you know, like you had like the whole epics of Gilgamesh and the whole idea of the fear of the forest, the fear of the wild places. That was done to control us. That was done to control us. So we have to move into cities, move into communities where we were a jurisdiction, administration and laws. Where in the reality, we're supposed to live in these places, these wild places.
Well, you know, I live in a pretty wild place up here in Scotland. The weather's pretty strong. I would say when I came to Ireland last year, I did a little spontaneous tour of the south of Ireland, and there were so many places that this is like home. This is like home. So it's like, it was like if you could take Scotland and then give it nice weather, or, you know, less wind maybe. That's probably it. It's probably less wind. Because it's just as much rain, and it's just as green. Oh, but that green, the moss, that lovely, like velvet green moss, that is just something that grows all over Ireland. That is like, this is, you know, you're somewhere, you're in paradise here. And it's just gorgeous.
Well, I think the difference between the weather, the rain in Ireland, the rain in Scotland is the rain in Ireland kind of comes down at 45 degrees. The rain in Scotland goes completely sideways.
That's right, 90 degrees. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, fantastic, place. And so, and also when you're talking about these things, it was like, all right, number one, Odin's wood. Would you describe, the spiritual, you know, did you actually, all right, here's the thing. I got a past life reading years ago and somebody says, oh yeah, you were there in the Viking times and, you sat in this little cottage and you spoke to Odin. I was like, oh really? Ah, I spoke to Odin. And it's like, you know, you have a personal relationship with Odin. Like people say they have a personal relationship with Jesus. You know, it's essentially that, inner archetypal force. Did you feel a strong sense of Odin's presence there?
No, not Odin. The Vildenvikin, the wild woman. I felt the presence of that much more. She's the kind of archetypal female feral spirit of the Odinvale. And along with many of the places like loaded with like folklore and mythology, but that one in particular, big time. Now the entity, the deity, I should say, that I do feel the strongest connection to is the Irish Morrigan or the Maca. This is the raven goddess. I have a tremendous personal connection to this entity, to this deity, this power force, this archetype. She's the battle goddess of the northern half of Ireland. She is a shape-shifting female, often takes the form of a raven. She's very closely connected to the Valkyries of the Nordic world in that she takes the souls of the dead and transports them to the other life. But she's also almost like an adjudicator of the battle of the actual, the conflict. There's an incredible story. There was a famous battle fought outside Dublin. I think it was in the year 1070. Don't quote me on that. Called the Battle of Clontarf between the Vikings and the Irish, for control of the city of Dublin. And, in the actual, on the Vikings side, they would be looking for the Valkyries. That would be their kind of, you know, their spirit. And the Irish would have been looking towards the Morrigan Maca, their raven kind of goddess. But in the actual accounts from the time of the battle, they said that both the Morrigan and the Maca, the Morrigan and the Valkyrie were fighting in the sky above the battlefield, like something like Lord of the Rings or something like that. These people lived in completely different, now that, they meant that on the archetypal level, on the spiritual level. I don't actually believe that, you know, Odin is a man or Thor is a being or the Krom is a being. What they are energy forces. They're just names. Just like in Hinduism, the Vedic people don't actually believe that these, like Krishna is an actual person, or they believe they are names to describe aspects of the universe, the cosmos, and also forces of the subconscious mind, the psychic mind, and so on. That's my relationship to them. So when I think of Odin, I think of him representing the sort of paternal, patriarchal aspect of the human experience in the cosmos, wisdom, caring, the seeking of knowledge, the sense of sacrifice, and all these things, to put them into anthropomorphic, or even in the case of the Maca, a zoomorphic aspect. It gives you a much more stronger spiritual connection to the idea of this guy up in the clouds, you know, playing a harp or passing judgment and things like that. In the Abrahamic religions, there's a tremendous power. So when I was in the Odinvale, you know, I powerfully sensed the Vildenvikin, and I wouldn't have been surprised if this kind of hairy wild woman would have stepped out of the woods. But the thing was that was me and my subconscious mind, my psychic experience pouring itself into this natural environment, and this symbiotic relationship of this natural environment pouring itself back to me. You know, like we're both electronic geeks. You know the way induction works between two coils? There you have like they don't actually touch in the transformer. They're just the electromagnetic forces just jump between the two. Now that's, you know, it through a kind of an unknown space. That's how it felt. I was actually communicating on the archetypal level with these power forces, these archetypes through this like unknown space. And I think that's why I want to, I miss this place, because I felt in that unknown space between my subconscious mind and the archetype of the Fildenbicken is where the secrets of the universe lie. You know what I mean? I got a sample of the ever beyond.
Thank you. I believe that there is a European or pan-European going all the way across to Siberia and really ringing the world, a shamanic network that has always existed. I watched Dune the other week, and you know, it's like the Bene Gesserit, this secret society that is everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Even in the Dune, you know, even on the Dune planet, there were Bene Gesserit, even though the guild didn't know about them, you know. And so there's this network. I believe that, have you heard of these books called Anastasia, the Anastasia series?
Yeah, it's some lady shaman in Siberia
That's right. Well, I believe she is she's just one example come to the surface, but they're, you know, the place is covered with them. And this archetypal female energy that you're talking about reminds me, it beckons me towards that thing going on. Who knows who is who? And in fact, you know, we are little bugs clinging to the outside of this thing hurtling through space. Yeah. You know, the idea of, you know, if you're on a ship, would you like to be on the deck or would you like to be strapped to the hull? I know where I'd like to be.
That's a beautiful analogy. I really like that. Yeah. You know, it's only now I think humanity, and for all its faults, the internet has played an enormous part in this, that it's only now humanity has the ability, if it wants, to guide itself rather than to be, you know, led. So that's, we're talking about people like myself, yourself, the kind of people we know in our personal lives. There are people who might listen to this show, or the people who follow your work, follow my work. Well, we have us rather than, you know, someone who watches X Factor. And I'm not putting these people down. I'm just saying it's a different world for them than it is for us. But I think we have chosen to manifest, if you want to use a kind of a Hindu idea, at an amazing time for this, because we have the, you know, here I am, a guy who can throw myself into this wild forest in Germany, but I still have access to the internet, so I can talk about it to someone like you, to explain to other people. And the internet's an incredibly powerful tool for people like us. It allows us, like you said, to, you know, get off the hole and get onto the deck. I think that's a lot, you know, and people are, you know, that's what the internet is. It's a phenomenal extension, and I don't mean in a transhumanist way, of our conscious potential if you engage with it the right way, rather than, you know, allowing it to lead you wherever you want to go or being caught up in some kind of fear thing or something. But yeah, absolutely. That's a beautiful analogy. I love that.
Yeah. So the idea of like cavemen, being like early humans and all that stuff may not be, you know, it might just be like, it's, you know how the weather's getting weird and the sun's turning white? Well, what happens when the sun turns blue and, we're just showered with, excessive UV radiation? We won't be able to go outside in the daytime. We'll have to live in, you know, places where that ultraviolet won't penetrate.
Speaking of the sun changing color, that's happened in quite a short time. When
back in the
early 80s, I can, you know, being an artist, like you said, I'm always looking at shadows, and I'm always, you know, I was looking at some of my drawings and my simple watercolors. I wasn't that good back then. And my shadows on my landscape paintings had a distinctive purple tone. Now they've moved towards a colder blue. And I've noticed that even in photographs. If you look at photographs, now I know there's all kinds of processes involving emulsion and films and all that kind of thing. And you have differences between Agfa film and Fuji film and etc. But without a doubt, if you look at photographs from the early 80s, shadows are purple in tone, and everything in under sunlight has an orange hue-ish. There's a kind of an orange amber subtle hue to it. Now, if you look at artwork even from then, like landscape paintings, I have tons of like art magazines gone way back years. The paintings are painted like them. Now the shadows are a colder blue. They're a colder blue, and apparently I don't know where I read it. It might have been a New Scientist magazine, but the sun itself has lost red from its spectrum in only since the late 70s. It has lost the color red and has moved closer to a blue. So you may be really onto something there. Now again, is this change in the color of the sun a reflection of shifts in human consciousness? Because I absolutely believe the two are interconnected.
Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. If you stick a butter knife in the kitchen flame, in the kitchen stove, you know, I'm sure lots of young men used to do that, it first glows cherry red, and then it glows yellow, and then it glows white, and then if you start acetylene torch on it, it'll glow blue. You know,
yeah.
So basically what we're seeing is the rise of the color temperature. Now, whether there's an actual, mechanical heating going on, or there is, you know, because we talk about an electric universe as the sun is more like an electric thing. So that would mean perhaps a change in voltage or a change in frequency that is driving the sun in its work. So I believe that there are also these waves, because I feel these strange sort of psychic waves. It's a bit like when you're standing on the beach you're standing in the water and it's just lapping backwards and forwards. You feel this current flow as it ebbs and flows. That I'm sensing these very, very subtle shifts, like I'm in some kind of wave. When I feel those, that's when things seem to happen in the earth. So you've often been, posting things. Oh, I feel really weird this morning. You know, it's very unusually strange. And I believe this is to do with, emanations from the sun, which is, being affected by something else.
Completely believe that. Yeah, I totally believe that. The sun, you see, we have to, we have to understand that, we are the sun, and to a level the sun is us. You know, we are made of the same stuff ultimately. But there's also an element, I believe, of like a kind of a quantum entanglement connected to all of these events, in that somehow that you can, like, I'll give you an example. This is going to be you want a controversial one? Here's one for you. About 9 years ago, I first found out about the whole chemtrails thing, right? And I said, and like everyone else, I said, that's kind of interesting. There is a lot more trails in the sky than when I was a kid. And I only ever remember seeing the vapor trail, that trail behind an airplane. I don't ever remember, just like on the internet, what it said. I don't ever remember seeing these thick, heavy trails in the sky. No, that persist. Now, from that point on, because I took, now this is going to piss some people off, but I'm telling, this is the truth. From that point on, wherever I went in Britain or around there, anywhere, the sky was filled with these heavy, thick chemtrails that were called chemtrails. Kept looking at them, kept photographing them, kept even getting the zoom lens on my camera to take a picture of the plane that was doing them. They became not an obsession, but they became a fascination. And I said, there has to be something to this. There's something not right there. And I went through everything. Are plane engines bigger today? Is the sun changing the way water vapor processes itself? I went through everything. And there are more flights, the usual thing. And not being able to find any hard evidence for these things, in terms of like, chemicals being produced or anything like that. About 2010, 11, I said, fuck it. I said, I'm not going to even think about these epoxy chemtrails ever again. Well, from that moment on, when I kind of forgot about them and they were out of my consciousness, there was less of them in the sky. And that's honestly true. To this day, I hardly ever see them. When I hear other people tell me in this part of Ireland, they see them it all the time. A part of me, now you could, let's jump the conspiratorial thing to the next level. What if the powers that be know that if people put all their focus on these so-called chemtrails, that it actually manifests them? Just putting the idea out there. And that's why they want, through certain fear jocks on the radio, people thinking about chemtrails, chemtrails, that they're actually seeing them as a kind of a manifestation of their primal fears projected into the sky. Because we know all through history that whenever there was a great kind of great fear in society, that it always showed up in the sky as lights or strange signs or all kinds of things like this. During the 1950s, the terror of the communists in America, the sky was filled with UFOs. But that was not new. Before the Renaissance or late Middle Ages, there are numerous woodcuts of Swiss cities where the sky was full of UFOs. And then they weren't spaceships, they were lights, they were balls of light. And they were manifestations of the terror of the encroaching Islamic world on Europe. Put out there into people, they were being told the sky was full of devils and demons and all this kind of thing. So just to throw it out there, are things like that what we call chemtrails? And we don't hear about so much about them now as we did a few years back in the kind of conspiratorial world. Are they projections of consciousness into the sky that we ourselves generate? I'll tell you something, JP, and this is absolutely true. When someone is learning magic for the first time, one of the first things you learn to do is to work with water vapor. You can actually dissolve clouds in the sky. Water vapor is the easiest material that human consciousness can actually alter. So for instance, if there's a single cloud in the sky, you can cloud bust it. This is why Wilhelm Reich and his Argon generator was blowing clouds out of the sky. It was like basically a machine that was turbocharging that human consciousness intention using the sex energy or whatever. And you can blow them out of the sky. You can do it. I've done it. The next stage after that is you can actually create in a blue sky. I've done it for friends in Avebury in England, a perfectly blue sky. I manifested a white cloud. When you get really good at it, you can do things like make it rain indoors. You can make it rain inside your living room. Now, this is because your extreme will can actually cause water in the air around you to condense and form into water vapor. I'm starting to wonder now if these so-called chemtrails, just throwing it out there, are something like that. And if the powers that be have a vested interest in having as many people as possible fired up about it, scared about it, that they're actually generating them themselves.
Well, it's the thing that the more you focus on something, the more it happens. You know, like when you buy a red car, suddenly you see all the red cars in the street. I'd say that there are at least three levels to this. Number one is, as you say, you know, there are people who are creating the chemtrails. Number two, we know that there are chemtrail patents and things like that. And that the powers that be, the dark cabal, are looking to find ways of making a huge holographic projection screen to do whatever big show that they want to do to try and scare everybody. Where was the other one? No, there are three levels. Oh, that's the other two. But the thing is,
and the consciousness, the third would be the consciousness. Yes. Of what I've done. Yeah.
Exactly. But when I went to Ireland, I was, to be honest, Thomas, I was absolutely shocked because where did we go? It was right down south, in the Waterford district. Okay, so yeah. Down on the southeast. We went to this lovely little, castle place on the thing and we just sat there watching the sea off the bay. And and suddenly I thought, look at that. Wow. And it was really intense. And, what it looked like is that they were that kind of building up like a little crosshatch thing. That would then float over the bigger cities. It's like outside of, you know, they were like creating something that would then, you know, be blown by the wind onto the cities. It was like they're trying to it's like almost like pulling up a screen.
Yeah.
A whole, so it's like, a whole solid thing almost.
So you're saying like they were building a grid out in the Celtic Sea and floating into Waterford City?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that story as well so many times. And I think just, you know, I've never seen anything like that. But I know a few people have told me that they've actually seen that effect. You know, here's another one I've seen. And this is really weird. And I know I've looked at it from like every kind of possible, you know, prosaic angle. A black tube sometimes appears in front of these quote unquote chemtrails. The plaque tube is in front of it, and then the plane flies in, and I've seen it, flies into the tube and creates this so-called chemtrail. Now, what is interesting is the C part again. Now, I've looked, it's not the sun projecting it forward, it's not anything like that, it's not a shadow of the trail pushed in front of it on the sun behind it. It doesn't matter where the sun is, you see this thing.
That's interesting. I've not heard of the tube thing.
Yeah, like it's like a black misty tube. It's the weirdest thing. I've actually seen it on dull days. Now, on the beach, Strandhill in Sligo, a fabulous, a beautiful, stunning place, looking out to the ocean, my friend, who's an ex-British Army signals and signals guy, we have watched these things appear out of the ocean, not from the natural curvature of the earth, you know, the curving on the atmosphere, but actually shooting up out of the ocean, like the ocean is projecting them, like from a submarine or something. And then suddenly, lo and behold, this aircraft appears, spraying what appears to be putting this thick. Now, like I said, since I said, fuck it, I'm not going to do this anymore, I haven't seen them. Like, so it's almost like, so that's why I'm bringing the conscious thing into it. I think your theory is correct. There is the real stuff that they do, whatever, geoengineering, whatever. I know about those pains, but that's only stage one. Stage two is like the kind of Roswell thing where they throw the idea, they turbocharge the idea into human consciousness. So we start to generate them. They don't actually have to do them. That we actually generate them. Just like, you know, the best book ever written on UFOs is Carl Jung's book on flying saucers from 1947. We said, as the Cold War increases, people will see more UFOs and more alien flying saucers because the consciousness will project them, and the powers that be will have a vested interest in assisting that by building the hype up. And I'm seeing the same thing with the, so it's like what they call, you know, multi-spectrum warfare and non-linear warfare, whatever. Things are so weird out there in terms of the control structure that to actually pin down and say, oh, they're spraying us with chemical, that's not enough. That's just not enough. It's happening on the material level. It's happening on the spiritual level. It's happening on the psychic level. All three are working in tandem. And this is the mistake that people who wake up to the control system and they start getting obsessed with the conspiracy theory part. Oh, it's all government, it's all government, all government. What they're missing on is the consciousness part and the spiritual part. And that's actually where the battle is really raging.
It's a, it's, as you say, it's multi-spectrum. The, it's a cross between the Truman Show, the what's that other one? Star Wars and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with its kind of comedy aspect that there's, I still get the idea that there's some sort of Keystone Cops thing that's going on, that it's not quite as smooth and efficient as the bad guys like to project. It's like they're just
precisely. It's those things, it's those movies you've mentioned, but it's also that movie from the early 80s, Altered States. It's also a mindfuck.
Absolutely. Psychological operations. Now, we've come up to the top of the hour, so rapidly, brilliantly. Let's talk about some of the psyops that are going on, in the next hour, because, you know, you're a keen observer of the, what's that word you use? The tropes. I think you can talk about some tropes, after this. And this is a song by the Sulphur Factory, which is about, tell us about this song. This is How People Are Made. Tell us a bit about this song. Did you write it?
I played everything on that except the drums. I can't play, I can play drums, but a friend of mine played drums on that. Oh, and I think he played some of the bass as well. No, the song was just about the phonies. That's really what it's about.
Well, some genuine Sheridan here for you, the Sulphur Factory. Oh yes, and we're back. And I'm just back from the kitchen. Cup of tea for you, there. Right. And we're on with, hopefully, Thomas, are you back?
I am indeed.
Oh, fabulous. So, yes, where we were, psychological operations, psyops, things to feck with our heads. One of the reasons to do it is to keep us from waking up or, basically from rebelling, against the system that they're trying to impose. And it's done very subtly. So one of the ways to deflect an organization in budding is to co-opt or own the organization before it gets off the ground. So you drop in one of your people and right at the beginning, keep them quiet until some point and they can steer the agenda. This has been happening within what's been what you call the Truffer movement with an F. It's kind of ongoing, but do you want to chart some of the progress that you saw, what they were trying to do, what they tried to achieve, and whether they did achieve it?
Well, the biggest one before even the Truffer movement existed was something called the Over Here PSYOP. That's what I call Over There PSYOP. Basically, it's been since probably Victorian times, Charles Dickens called it telescopic philanthropy. The idea that you ignore the problems in your own community because you're more concerned with what's going on in another country. This has been a classic PSYOP that was developed. It's almost like the altruistic distraction. So there was a famous cartoon and punch of that Charles Dickens himself commissioned. And it shows like starving children in London and these wealthy people looking through telescopes at suffering people overseas. And that was a classic, the idea of like, you care more about what goes on in the Middle East or any other part of the world than you do in your own community. That's also a spiritual thing as well. There's a spiritual kind of version of that, believing that spiritual salvation exists in the Peruvian jungle. rather than in the forest down the road from you. You know, that kind of thing, or the coastline or the whatever down the road from you. And that even went as far as things like entheogens, like, you know, you're surrounded by magic mushrooms, but you have to go to Peru and get ayahuasca to be truly spiritual. That's always been a big thing. That's all. Now in the truther movement, well, there's just, I couldn't even begin to, you know, name the amount of psyops, you know, waiting for the aliens to come and save our asses so we don't have to save our own asses. Waiting for 2012, that was a classic one, to happen so we don't actually do anything ourselves to improve our own lives. Waiting for a savior, a Russell Brand, a Occupy movement, a Zeitgeist movement, a you feckin' name it. So you don't actually have to start moving on improving your own life now, because someone is doing it for you, or it's on the way. The Schumann resonance. The Schumann resonance is increasing, even though that means nothing at the hour. Out of the 100 monkeys, they're waking up. Now, even if that was true, you're an individual. Your job is to actually work on your own shit. Forget about that. Not wait for something to happen. But they made humans spiritually, psychologically, intellectually lazy. So they'll wait for someone to come along and kickstart the spiritual or the peaceful or the whatever revolution. Yeah, it's full of it. I mean, that's why I don't have anything really much to do with it. Except, I mean, I know there's a lot of nice people involved in it. And, I think a lot of people, sincere people involved in it, but I also see it's full of sort of bullshit as well. And, my attitude is you don't ever wake up. What you do is you kind of open your eyes and you come out of your sleep, but you don't suddenly wake up. It's different progressions of coming out of that sleep. And, so you're always looking around. You're always having a keen eye. You don't jump on the next solution or whatever. I mean, you mentioned Russell Brand there. That, like, did my head in a few years ago when that happened, where people that I taught were clued in. You know, they've been spending years sharing videos about celebrities can't be trusted, blah, 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 all this kind of thing. And then they follow this guy who's is as thick as shit, says nothing, basically stole. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of like David Icke's work per se, but I do admire the man and what he's done to wake people up and things like that. I do admire that. I think he's a genuinely decent person who means well. But to see the likes of how clearly and obviously Russell Brand was moved in to like grab that whole scene and take it over and steer it into the Labour Party. Just like I predicted 2 years before he did it, his job was to get people to vote for Labour. And even when it happened and he was actually making his Truths video and saying vote for Labour, they still didn't believe it. They still didn't believe it. They still thought that he was going to lead them on some kind of, consciousness revolution to kind of freedom. And that's the biggest psyop of all, making people personally lazy.
Dragging them back into the the left right paradigm. I mean, hasn't anybody got that yet? That's just anyway. So there he was. Instead of making people spiritual, he's saying vote because that's going to make you. That's going to do the right thing, and so. And this reminds me of something that I read years and years ago about, you know, the Illuminati dark plan. Was one of them was to no longer trust politicians, but to trust celebrities. And I was, you know, I've been sort of watching this thing roll out with the likes of Simon Cowell and with all these people who are, you know, whose opinion is valued. Well, but
JP, they all died a death when Trump got elected.
Thank
you. Look at all the celebrities that rode in behind, you know, that psychopath Hillary Clinton and attacked Trump nonstop. And that is that to me will always be the most amazing thing about Trump's election, is how the celebrities got their arses handed to them back to them on a plate by the public. We don't care what you think. And that must have, that, you know, just if it, I don't care what you think about Trump or anything like that, just, or what kind of person he is, forget about all that stuff, just on that factor of alone, for, you know, the majority of the American people who are the most brainwashed, celebrity-bombarded culture on earth, to say to these celebrities, you ain't shit. And that's why they went into a state of shock. That's why you had the likes of Rosie O'Donnell, and not just them, all of them, going into psychotic convulsions, Michael Moore, all of them, because they could not believe that they were not gods anymore. And that, to me, was a beautiful moment, a beautiful moment that I will treasure, cherish forever.
You know, the Chenrezig Puja, they're going for refuge, a Tibetan Buddhist thing, talks about the different levels of demons and things. And one of them is the realm of the demigods. And, their suffering is to, exchange, their suffering is to rise and fall, to rise and fall, to rise. So there is always a fall after all the rises. And, you know, you see that in the whole press thing. And
the whole Dionysian thing.
Mm.
You know, you worship Dionysus and then you rip him to bits.
Yeah. So that's the other kind of god, isn't it? So, what we're looking at recently, I'm just trying to bring this all up to date with, you know, there are still traps and, first of all, trope. Can you explain what a trope is to us, simple folk?
A trope, in my understanding, from playing role-playing games, I love RPG games, is the idea that something becomes, an accepted norm out of the blue, or a way of identifying an emerging social norm. So a classic one in the Truther movement would be the flat earth thing. It immediately appeared overnight, all plugged in and ready to go, in such a way to make as many people as possible fall for that scam. In everyday life, something like a fidget spinner. Can anyone explain to me why every single discount shop on Earth, on literally the same day, had billions of these fidget spinners ready to go? You know what I'm saying? These tropes, mega trends was a common word used for them in the 70s, that suddenly manifest within society, and they give you indications of where human consciousness or human development, social, culture, whatever, is going.
Excellent. So I'm just looking at the chat room here, and Vanessa's the moderator here, and one of the moderators, and she's saying, I agree, it was a full anti-programming vote. It's like the people who voted for Trump had finally had enough, really, of all the browbeating given by the mainstream news, and they kept doing it, and they still keep doing it, and they haven't really stopped, have they?
Because their own irrelevancy is staring them in the face. It's a case of, like, you know, people voted for someone who wasn't a politician. That's really what it came down to. And that's also why the political system was terrified. Brexit was another example of that as well. If you give human beings in a democracy a chance to vote for anything that isn't political, they'll vote for it. You know what I'm saying? Like, the whole British establishment didn't want Brexit, so people who hadn't voted in years went out just to stick it to them. And the same thing happened with Trump. It's like, we're sick of the Democrats, we're sick of the Republicans, even the Republicans didn't like Trump, remember that. And it was a way of sticking it to them. And it showed ironically, although these lunatics and these unhinged whack jobs are all screaming about the death of American democracy, the exact opposite happened. The actual American people showed them that they still believed in democracy. That's what really happened. And that's what really frightens these people, because they, for all the talk about democracy and, you know, free elections, it's just like, you know, the European Union will accept your vote as long as you vote for what we want you to vote for. And when it goes against that grain, they go absolutely batshit crazy.
You know, the other thing about Trump is that not a lot of people speak about it. Is this thing, he was like the Alan Sugar of America, wasn't he? He was on their version of that, Dragon's Den that we have here.
And no, but he was bigger than, yeah, exactly. So, but he was bigger than that. I lived in New York for years, and he, even back then in the 80s and 90s, he cast an enormous shadow on that city, because basically he had built this real estate empire, but he'd also done things like rescued places like Atlantic City in New Jersey, which had fallen apart, and he'd actually rejuvenated that entire city and brought it back from like being basically a ghetto on the coast into a very popular vacation destination. He did things, you know, like he was seen as a guy who could get things done, and a lot of people, that's why a lot of working class people respected him. For that reason, there's an interview with Trump from years ago, from the late 80s, where he says, I don't like the elite in this city. That, you know, he's talking about the old money in New York, the Rockefellers, and the Catholic Church is extremely powerful in New York City. You know, the whole St. Patrick's Cathedral and all that. So he said, they don't like me. He goes, who likes me is the, who I get on with, like the taxi drivers and all this stuff. Now, the guy's a billionaire, but yeah, I totally get that. It's amazing how, until he became involved in politics, he was seen as a go-to guy who could get bullshit sorted. But as soon as he turned into became a real politician, they all started attacking him. Because politics is about getting nothing sorted, about having everything in a state of perpetual
absolutely,
chaos.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's because that's why it was there. It's just a boondoggle. It's like it's really somebody's hobby. It really should be relegated to the level of that's just somebody's hobby. Oh, yeah. But while everybody else gets on with living.
I also, another thing with Trump too, I find that, you know, like, and I'll say this too about Obama. I found it disgusting. I didn't like what Obama represented. I found it disgusting how people used to attack his wife.
Oh, so here we are. We're back. There's a bit.
Tony Hart's Vision On.
That's right. That's right. I love that tune. I use it as my kind of
It's real dreamy and beautiful, actually.
Yeah, it's just a lovely old tune. I can't remember the name of it. It's by the Something Tones. I'll get it back.
They used to play it when he.
Yeah. Go ahead.
They used to play it when he showed the paintings and the artwork of the deaf kids.
That's right. All the children's drawings and, you know, it's just watercolors, just nice colors and things like that. So meanwhile, should we talk about Michelle Obama? But that's the last thing we heard, is that you said that everybody was getting on her, for being a man.
Yeah, those kinds of things. And also, now they're the same people who are pissed off at that attacking, you know, Trump's youngest child. Calling him all, that kid Barron Trump, calling him all kinds of names. It's disgusting, you know, it's like, that's how dirty politics is in the media.
Do you know, I think there's, well, I'm just gonna be in conjecture here, but I think that, that child has been damaged by vaccines, and like, they know, and I think the pharma, vaccine lobby are very nervous about Trump being there, because
I think it's true. He's gonna, and I think that
if I were him, you know, if I was a billionaire and I wanted to do something about something, I'd do exactly what Trump was doing, because that's the heart of it, is the well, I call it the death industry, because it goes from abattoirs to arms companies to chemical companies, from chemical companies to drug companies. to pharma lobbies and their connections. And who knows what kind of spare drugs pharma companies can produce for special friends like politicians and things like that. So they're so tied together, hand in hand, that it really would take somebody with a great big sledgehammer like Trump to break this. We never know.
Yeah, yeah, there's all kinds of ways of looking at it, but yeah, we'll never know. But, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't see white hope or anything like that. I wanted him to win that election because I wanted chaos in the system. Because I think human beings are at their best when there's chaos. They're at their worst when there's conformity. I always have seen that chaos brings out the best in humanity. That conformity and sameness and conservatism and knowing what tomorrow is going to be like brings out the worst in humanity. And I saw Trump's election as a spanner in the works of consciousness. And I mean, you saw me on Facebook. I actually said I endorsed him and I made a video of it. And, you know, thousands of people got involved in America because of that. And I play a tiny part in it, but I'm glad I did. I wanted that spanner in the... I don't care about anything. I wanted that spanner thrown into consciousness, and he was right for
it. He's just certainly like a wild card, isn't he?
Yeah. I love anything that rattles the establishment. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, and I see a kind of wry grin on him, like, you guys can't do anything about this. This is like, we're a force whose time has come.
And all the gaslighting too, like trying to make out he's an idiot and he's stupid. Oh, come on, you don't run those businesses at that success and that level if you're stupid.
Well, according to one thing, that, you know, he's got the highest IQ of any president ever. So, yeah, but he's, you know... What was that thing? The art of making a deal. Perhaps it's connected with the art of war. He probably read that when he was a young man and realized that business is a war, and you have, you know, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why he's not part of the establishment for that reason. Again, you know, he looks at things differently. I think, like, you know, look at all the horrors that were predicted. You know, when he was elected, they said that gay people would be locked up in prison camps and had electrodes put to their genitals to make them straight. Oh, I mean, the liberals went completely psychotic, and they showed that, you know, that essentially liberalism is a form of mental illness. If they ever wanted to prove that, boy, have they proved that in spades. And I say this as someone who used to consider myself once a liberal, but what liberalism has become, I want no part of it.
Telling me, you know, I used to think I was a lefty until lefties started going like Nazi. How the heck's going on with them?
Yeah, that's how I felt as well. I mean, yeah, I used to think, like, you know, I used to even be like involved with the Green Party years ago until I found out that the last thing they're involved in is the environment.
Actually, let's go there. As a few months ago, you did publish a short, I think it was a short video. I think we played it. But the occult roots of the Green Party. Do you want to go into that a little bit for our people?
Well, yeah, it's called The Cult Greens, and it's a film I'm very proud of, actually. And the film is on my open source occult TV channel. Now, the Green Party's roots are German. The Green Party is German. And I went over to Germany, and I went to a place called Darmstadt, which is in the, it's about 20, 25 kilometers south of Frankfurt, the suburbs of Frankfurt. It's in the Frankfurt metro area. Very interesting small city. It was where the Tsarina, the last Tsarina of Alexandria of Russia, have an Orthodox church there, but it was also, it's full of occult, interesting occult buildings. It's where, it's actually, it's a center of the biotech and the sort of quantum physics part of Germany. They're involved, it's a lot of CERN kind of stuff goes on there. It's a weird place. But they also have this weird temple And this temple was basically a house in the suburbs, which it's in the film, I show it. And it basically was the gestation of the German Green Party. Now, the German Green Party grew out of a kind of a post-World War II naturalist, nudist culture. These are people who were big into nudity and the naturalist culture. And there was a split that happened. Half of them went to California and founded the hippie movement. The other half stayed in Germany, and they founded what became the genesis of the Green Party. It was basically an ecological movement based heavily on nudity, on the whole nudist, the nudist lifestyle, and so on. Harmless enough, bunch of hippies, not really bothering anybody. Until 1980. In 1980, there was a couple basically leading the German Green Party. A woman called Kelly and a German gentleman who was a former Third Reich military, no, it wasn't the Wehrmacht, but he was in World War II, leader. And they were both found dead in 1980. And this was the earliest Green Party. And it was a thing called, I can't remember the name of it again, but the Agenda 80 or something like that. They were found dead, and it was decreed a double suicide. Like, he shot her and then killed himself. Within the German Green Party, they tried to make out that the Secret Service, the CIA, whatever, had killed them off because they were a threat to German industry, because they wanted to clean up the Rhine. They were going after all these big German petrochemical companies like Bass and Agfa and, you know, Siebeck IB and all these other companies to try and clean up the Rhine and make them pay fines for all the pollution in the Rhine. They were, that was this theory put out there. The reality is they were probably more likely murdered by who took over the Green Party. Because the Green Party then was taken over by a guy called Fischer. And this guy Fischer was basically a hardcore Marxist terrorist. This guy had been heavily involved in Baader-Meinhof. He eventually became the deputy prime minister of Germany under Gerhard Schroeder. This is how spooky it is. He was heavily involved in extreme Marxist politics within West Germany, the old West Germany, that included bombing, you know, police stations, riots, collecting arms, and very closely associated the groups like the Red Army faction, who were an IRA type operation, and the Baader-Meinhof, who you heard of, that they were bombing all over Germany. Again, they were a bunch of like typical left-wing revolutionaries, wealthy family backgrounds, you know, basically blowing up innocent people and shooting them and assassinating them. He was definitely involved in the assassination of a Hessian, that's a province, Hesse, in southern Germany, a senior government minister down there. It was his car that was used to drive the assassin and his gun to the government buildings to shoot him. Now, this guy Fischer then in time became the leader of the Green Party in Germany, this is a thing called Agenda 90, sorry. And along with them, they brought in pedophiles. Now, I know this sounds incredible, but the government platform, and you can watch the film Occult Greens, of the Green Party in Germany, where all Green Parties are still to this day sort of like spiritually orientated towards. German Green Parties are the mecca of all Green Parties all around the world, even to this day. Pedophilia was a major part of, legalizing pedophilia was a major part of their political platform. I am not joking you. So they had two agendas. One was globalization and the other one was pedophilia. And then on the side, cleaning up the environment. And they successfully brainwashed middle-class hippie types to vote for them because they thought they were an ecology party, they would clean up society and this kind of thing. In reality, it was a delivery mechanism for extreme Marxism. That's why they're called watermelons. Green on the outside, red on the inside. And the Green Party in Germany is, it's just amazing that all these people who wrote books about the beauty of having sex with children, the beauty of the sexuality of five-year-old boys, went on to become senior cabinet members in Germany, along with members of the Council of Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission, while the other aspects and other parts of the Green Party in Germany became major globalists, best friends, and even deputy prime ministers of Germany under the Gerhard Schroeder government, former terrorists. The whole Green Party movement was originally started out as a bunch of hippies who wanted to clean up, you know, the hippie kind of view of the world, peace, love, and nature. Taken over by extreme lefties, and that's what the Green Movement has been ever since in every country. And it comes from this temple that I visited in Darmstadt, a weird pseudo-pedophilia bestiality nature cult where they celebrate the sexual relationships between adults and children, but also humans and animals. And they have paintings of, you know, naked men in kind of sexual positions with stags in the German mountains while there's an explosion of light around them. This weird kind of, I can't even begin to describe it, but if you watch this documentary, The Occult Greens, you will see how utterly creepy and weird that PSYOP is behind their whole recycling and, you know, cleaning up the environment agenda.
That's fascinating. The other thing about the pedo thing is I remember Theresa May from the 70s having something to do with a group called the Paedophile Information Exchange.
Yeah, PIE.
And how they connected with lots of, it was the civil liberties people and things like that. Because they were trying to get everything legalized. So, what do you think of now? How's everything, connecting in now, as you can see?
In the 1970s, there was definitely a general desire to legalize pedophilia in Europe anyway, but also in America with NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. You even had a former U.S. presidential candidate who ran against Reagan in the actual presidential election called the caucus, who actually was involved with NAMBLA. For some reason, the late 70s and early 80s, the establishment became obsessed with legalizing pedophilia. It didn't happen because, A, the majority of society don't desire to have sex with children. They're not insane like these politicians and these elites. And B, a lot of Catholic clergy sex scandals broke around the same time. And so this kind of like stopped them in their tracks. But have no fear. Among the aristocrats, I still prefer to use the term the aristocrats, I still prefer that, there is a desire, an almost pathological drive, an insatiable compulsion to sodomize children. Where that comes from, I don't know. Why it exists, I don't know. Is there an occultic aspect to it? Absolutely there is. Is there something to do with their culture, these like public schools, aristocrats, and all this kind of thing? Yeah, I think there is something to that. I think that's why they left Savile alone. The last time we did an amazing show a few years ago on Savile. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why Theresa May and the Paedophile Information Network, that's why you had the caucus in America with NAMBLA, that's why you have the Greens in Germany, in tandem with the Christian Democrats there, trying to legalize it. There was a big push between the late 70s and early 80s to legalize pedophilia, and it didn't happen for them. But that that agenda has not gone away.
Because it is the hallmark of tyranny. This whole sodomy, pedophilia, you know, it's happened for a long time, and this is nothing new. You know, we're talking many thousands of years from, you know, until they managed to destroy all of the records, they still were doing it. So, like, you can just assume that they just haven't stopped, and some, you know, they managed to wipe out some of the older records. But, they're still at it, and this is still the same people.
Yeah. In pagan Europe, they used to, if anyone was caught, if a pedophile was found, they would slit their throats and throw them into a bog so they wouldn't reincarnate. That was the punishment. They had their throat slit and they were thrown to a bog so they couldn't reincarnate. There was a belief that the bog trapped the soul forever. You had that in even in Tolkien, the grey marshes where the dead elves and the dead men were in the marsh forever. They couldn't come out. And this was a European folk belief that if someone sexually abused a child, they had their throat slit and thrown to the bog. And this existed in pagan Greece, believe it or not, until something pivotal happened in Greek society where they changed and became a kind of a monotheistic version of paganism. They went from worshipping the gods of the land. They saw all their gods, like all the Greek gods were represented in the sea, in the mountains, in, you know, Mount Olympus and all this kind of thing. You Halcyon days, you had like, you know, the kingfisher gods, you had all this kind of like classic paganism. And then something happened in Greek society where they transformed the gods of the landscape around them, the classic pagan gods and archetypes, and put them in the sky as constellations. And when that happened, it created an elite in Greece where suddenly you have this kind of this elite who were connected to the gods in the sky, and they were the ones who were the exclusive representations of the gods in the sky. And then they became very different than your standard European pagan. They developed an elite, and these elites would be the classic Greek pederasts that we would hear about in ancient times, sitting around the symposium discussing philosophy and this kind of thing, while they're being pleasured by young boys. And that's when it started. And there's this idea passed from the classical world into the sort of classical Christian world, and on and on and on, that the intellectuals are basically pedophiles. And they must be like the ancient Greeks who were pleasured by young prepubescent boys while they sat there pontificating about, you know, the philosophical nature of politics and the natural world. And that's where it came from. And that's where the rot started, when the gods of the earth and the goddesses of the earth were transferred into the heavens. And it created a separation, a dissociation in a spiritual dissociation in humans. And that's where it began. And all these bastards to this day, to the Jimmy Savills, to all these guys in these elite public schools in England, to the top end of the Catholic Church, they're all longing to get back to the symposium of Athens and Greece, ancient Greece, because it's a kind of like an earthly god kind of mentality.
So certainly a demigod state of being.
Demigod, yeah.
So, our mutual Facebook friend Harry, you know, we've got about 15 minutes left, and I just wanted to bring it up. Our friend Harry, wanted to talk about the connection between mathematics and music. Now I've got lots of number juggling, going on with the 432 thing. Yeah. All connected with powers of six and two and three and all that stuff. What's your feeling and what's your knowing? And also, I believe music, mathematics and magic are essentially one thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what the Renaissance. Yeah. And even the earliest Greek, scientists who worked out the musical scale, and then that passed from the classical world into the modern world. Well, it came back during the Renaissance. Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. There was a show called, it was called Howard Goodell's Big Bang, I think, on Channel 4 about 15 years ago. And he talked about the history of music, and he talked about the Archimedes, is it Archimedes or Pythagoras who came up with the idea of the musical scale? It's one or the other.
Pythagoras came up with the scale thing, and the proportions. Yeah.
And he said that on one hand it was a curse, because it created a regimental view of creativity. And then he compared that to Howard Goodell, compared that to, say, gypsy music. With gypsy, you know, Roma gypsy music is the music of Europe, that the last music of the West that doesn't conform to the Pythagorean scale. And he said, but at the same time, he could point to, you know, endless amounts of music from Wagner to the Beatles to whatever that justify the creation of a musical scale in a mathematical sense. So, yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I just like Howard Goodell does. I have mixed feelings about it. I think it creates a demarcation to structure music within a certain bandwidth of, you know, kind of a mathematical bandwidth. We're maybe losing out on a more kind of explorative musical style. Like, I was looking at these pictures of these ancient horns that were used by the ancient, you know, the Norse or the ancient Celts or the Gauls. These incredible, like, you know, war horns, they call them. And they were not tuned to any kind of pitch that we're, you know, familiar with. The same with the Aztecs and so on. They had these bizarre, like, whistles. And we've kind of ghettoized ourselves on one level, but it's worked tremendously well. You cannot argue with the, you know, the beauty of something like Mozart, which is built within that structure. Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. The whole 432, 440 thing. I don't know. I've looked at that. I've messed around with it. I know you're a superb guitar player. And myself, and I haven't seen or felt an enormous difference in that. How do you feel about that?
Well, as a, you know, just playing with an acoustic guitar, tuned to 432 instead of to 440, it's much easier for my croaky old voice to hit that E, to hit that top note, because it's just slightly flat. And it's almost like, hang on a second, that's... Maybe the people who, quote, sing flat are actually singing in this natural form.
But that's actually a great point, because I know opera singers who will tell me that they cannot sing outside 432 because, again, they struggle. If you're singing, say, you know, if you're doing an entire operatic performance in 440, the strain on the vocal cords is phenomenal. So I think in terms of singing, I absolutely agree. There's definitely an advantage to 432, but I don't know about in terms of musical instruments. But I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a valid point. I agree with that.
And, you know, and also you're talking about, you know, microtonal differences. And, of course, you know, probably you two as well. You know, I'm a blues guitarist, so I'm bending a lot of notes. So I'm scanning through the frequencies as well. And, you know, also to make those kind of Hendrix-y noises, you use heptadions that are, you know, really very close notes to each other. So you get, like, lots of different notes with it. And that produces low frequencies, like, you know, Schumann resonance level frequencies, just with that difference. And, in fact, it's just, you know, 7.83... is very close to 8, which is the difference between 432 and 440. Maybe I'm onto something here. But let's have a look. You know, meanwhile... Well, yeah, go on.
If you listen to those old Robert Johnson records, they were recording 432. And this is before the whole RCA Goebbels thing of like shifting the pitch up, which is not as spooky as many people think it is. A lot of that had to do with like because of the limitations of radio broadcast back in those days in terms of frequency and recording technology. But his records sound incredibly spooky when you listen to them now. Incredibly spooky. When I first heard like his version of Crossroads, I totally get why people said that he made a deal with the devil at a crossroads. His voice and the guitar and everything sounds unbelievably spooky. Now, so there's something to it in terms of that, but I don't think at the same time too, when you listen to the great, like even Hendrix or the great records that we all grew up with, that we should throw them out either because they're recording the wrong, you know, the wrong pitch. That's how I feel about it.
Absolutely, you know.
We should be puritanic. We shouldn't be puritanical about it.
Absolutely. I don't think we should be fanatical about anything, even, you know.
Yeah, there's room for both.
Indeed. So, now, there was one last thing on my list of things we were going to talk about. Ah, and it'll come to me probably just after the show's finished. What was it? Oh, talk about not being present. There we go. I passed a message from the chat room to you. You don't need to answer it just now, but it was about your experience in the Black Forest, in the Dark Forest. So it's an interesting little vignette for you. And what was it? It's on the edge of my consciousness and I can't kind of grab it. I'm sure it'll come back. So let's talk about while we're in this zone, you're doing a gig in Glastonbury. Are you going to the assembly rooms?
Yeah, I think so. It's not this. I thought it was next weekend. It's the weekend after. And it's the Glastonbury Symposium, which has been running for years. I've never done it. So I'm looking forward to that. I love that part of England anyway. And so that's like in a couple of weeks. I think it's probably sold out by now anyway. If anybody's listening in the US, I'm going to be in Houston in mid-September and almost certainly in Portland, Seattle and Olympia around Halloween time. And then also there's going to be an event in Reading area of London. I know it's not London, but that area, that part of England, in November. So I've got Glastonbury and a few other dates. So it's actually, you know, that I'm going to be, I've stopped speaking around. I actually stopped doing public talks there for a while and also interviews because I was getting sick of saying the same things over and over again. And I want to get back out there again and talking to people and meeting people. I do the AV events with Dean R. Crane every year in England, but that was the only thing I was doing. I was turning down everything else. I was kind of sick of saying and doing the same things. But yeah, I'll be there in Glastonbury in 2 weeks' time. And I don't know if there's still tickets available, but you can check on the Glastonbury Symposium website.
And are you going to hang out in the Glastonbury? I personally always like to visit the tree. Did I tell you my story about the tree? You know, the holy thorn.
Yeah, the holy thorn. I've got a piece of that right here in my wand.
Fabulous. Because I went up to it a couple of years ago after it had been like quote vandalized. I just sat there meditating to it and I said, oh, hi. And, you know, hi. How you doing? Oh, yeah, all right. Yeah, what about the lopping? It's all right. I was a stick once. That's what the tree said to me. It was all good. And the impression that I got from the tree was that, you know, as you have that magical piece of thorn in your wand, the Queen, Elizabeth has been given a piece of this thorn every year, hasn't she? It's a ceremonial thing. And it's like the thorn flowers. And since the thorn has not been growing, it has reduced the Queen's power. And that was what the tree told me.
Well, not interesting. You know, another interesting thing about that holy thorn is there's a little chapel next to it called St. Patrick's Chapel. It was St. Patrick who actually founded Glastonbury. And in that chapel is the most bizarre and strange painting of Mary Magdalene with the seven sins extending from her womb. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, no. That reminds me of the tour with the seven streams that come from it.
Yeah. The next time you're in Glastonbury, go into St. Patrick's Chapel. It's a little chapel that was probably was founded by St. Patrick. And at the back wall behind the altar is the most strangest painting you've ever seen. And it shows the womb of Mary Magdalene spawning the seven sins into the world. And that's literally next door to the Holy Thorn.
How bizarre. I've never seen that. I have to check that out. Thomas Sheridan, we are out of time. It has been a fabulous 2 hours. It's gone really quickly. Come back soon. Have a fantastic summer wherever you're going, and I look forward to seeing more of your shows. One question people said is Velocity of Now ever coming back?
I tried to record a few shows recently, but I just didn't have the goo on me, to use an art expression.
Yeah.
It just wasn't happening psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, but it will, of course it will come back. The Velocity of Now is me. But at this point in time, it's, you know, I've got so many things. I'm finishing up a book on magic. I got a new publisher in the US that's coming out. That'll be a major project for me. I'm recording an album at the moment, a very intense industrial metal album of something I've always wanted to do. And, you know, loads of other things, you know, it will come back. It's not finished. It's just in hibernation. That's all.
Fabulous. Because, not only is it a great show, but it's got, I think, one of the best theme tunes. I'm not crawling up your ass, but you know, everybody loves that theme tune. As it comes on,
I wrote that in 20 minutes on my old Yamaha synthesizer.
Excellent. That's the kind of inspired thing that happens, and it sticks. Fabulous.
Have you heard the remix of it?
I'd like to.
If you go to YouTube right now with Thomas Sheridan Arts on YouTube, and you will see a thing called Salvation. It's a music video. It was done by a chap called John Presley, and he remixed the theme tune, and it's fantastic.
All right, there it is. Right.
If you want to,
a month ago, and I'll play out that track. I'll just download it here and play it out as we just after my theme tune after finishes recording. So, Thomas Sheridan Arts, come on, reel off your enormous list of websites where people can see your stuff, but particularly where people can buy your stuff. Support this man, he's brilliant.
Thank you very much, and anytime you want me back, JP, you know, you're one of the few people I absolutely love, and your shows, and I love your personality, and I love everything about it, so anytime you ever want me back. Websites, streetdruid.net. That's a good one for all the links. ThomasSheridanArts.com. On YouTube, Thomas Sheridan Arts. And also all those documentaries and films, Open Source Occult TV. And that'll get you to everything.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much, Thomas Sheridan. This has been Ever Beyond. And stand by. We're going to hear a bit of Salvation after this theme tune, which is called Seven Steps to Heaven. All right, good night, Thomas, and thank you very much for coming around midnight. That's right. It was the 17th thing. The thing about the 17th. You have a thing about the 17th of July in 2017. That was what?
Yeah, very, very quickly. Back in April, I had a dream. A Germanic sounding voice said to me, July 17th. And that's all they said. And that starts right now. And nothing may happen, it may be me personally, but that's what it is. A voice clearly shouted out, July 17th.
And with that mysterious call from beyond, we are going ever beyond. Thank you very much, Thomas. Good night, and God bless you all.
Beyond.